Today's broadcast was originally recorded on February 24th, 2026.
Because my network clearly doesn't want us to talk about this, let's talk about this. You've probably heard.
Yeah, let's talk about this. Sounds like a good idea.
I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it is not.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. Get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am from Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles. This is the Brandcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and on dozens of other fine affiliate stations on both the Yes public airwaves and the internets around the country and the world. Blanketing Planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us again today. Welcome to the Bradcast. We've got a lot to get to today with a guest standing by to discuss some all-new thuggery by Trump's FCC and its chair, Brendan Carr, and later Desi Doyen, and our latest Green News report.
Yay.
Will be here for you.
Yes.
We'll see how much of a yay that is.
True.
Also, we will have full team coverage of Tuesday night's State of the Union address with Heather Digby Parton and the notorious Driftglass on tomorrow's broadcast. But as we go to air, I will note that anywhere from two dozen to as many as 40 Democratic members of Congress have said they do not plan to attend Trump's first official State of the Union address since taking office a second time. Some are announcing they intend to attend alternate events like the People's State of the Union, sponsored by Midas Touch media outlet and Move On Civic Action, or the so-called State of the Swamp event, headlined by some of the ICE protesters from Portland, Oregon, you may remember, who had dressed up in inflatable frog outfits last year. They have traveled to D.C. for an event that will also feature actors like Robert De Niro and Mark Ruffalo, as well as a bunch of different Democratic members of Congress, former governor, etc. Some Democrats say they plan to bring Jeffrey Epstein accountability to the State of the Union. For example, Ro Khanna of California, congressman, will reportedly be bringing Haley Robson, who has said that Epstein trafficked her starting when she was 16 years old. Congresswoman Maxine Dexter of Oregon is said to be having Lisa Phillips, an Epstein survivor, attend in her place. Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal of Washington is having an Epstein survivor attend in her place, and so on. I'm sure we'll be discussing all of that tomorrow. But very quickly, as we've been reporting in recent days on the missing Epstein files, identified as existing but missing from Department of Justice, the DOJ release of those files, which they falsely claim to be complete. Missing files, as initially identified by independent investigative journalist Roger Sullenberger, as we've been discussing over the past week or so. Those missing documents, among them in question, are transcripts of FBI interviews from 2019, most of them shortly before Epstein was found dead in his jail awaiting trial. Interviews with a woman who claims that she was raped, beaten, and threatened by Donald Trump at Epstein's New York home when she was just 13 years old. Well, we don't know if her allegations, as I've noted, are credible, but what we do know that they exist and that the FBI found her credible enough to interview her four different times. And three of those interviews were accompanied with handwritten FBI interview notes. And we know that those files are unlawfully missing from the DOJ's release of the files under the Epstein Files Transparency Act, which mandates the release of those documents, whether the allegations are credible or not. We also know, as we discussed yesterday, that there is some evidence to suggest that some of those files could have been part of the trove of documents that Donald Trump unlawfully stole upon leaving office the first time back in 2021 when he refused repeated requests, even under threat of jail time, to return those documents to the federal government for some reason. And since we know for sure that these documents exist and have not been produced along with the other files so far released by DOJ, we know that DOJ is, yes, in violation of the law. They have not released all of the files that they are statutorily required to release until at least these files, credible or otherwise, are published by the DOJ related to allegations that Donald Trump raped and abused a 13-year-old girl at his longtime best friend Jeffrey Epstein's house. Salacious, yes, but also true and accurate as far as the document's existence and the cover-up by Trump's DOJ, or we would not have covered it in the first place. Well, today, I'm happy to say, it is now not only independent journalists like Sullenberger or outlets like The Bradcast who are reporting on and trying to shine a spotlight on this matter. Today, according to National Public Radio this morning, quote, the Justice Department has withheld some Epstein files related to allegations that President Trump sexually abused a minor, an NPR investigation finds. It also removed some documents from the public database where accusations against Jeffrey Epstein also mentioned Trump. Some files have not been made public despite a law mandating their release, reports NPR's Stephen Fowler. These include what appear to be more than 50 pages of FBI interviews, as well as notes from conversations with a woman who accused Trump of sexual abuse decades ago when she was a minor. NPR reviewed multiple sets of unique serial numbers appearing before and after the pages in question, stamped onto documents in the Epstein Files database, FBI case records, emails, and discovery document logs in the latest tranche of documents published at the end of January. NPR's investigation found dozens of pages that appear to be cataloged by the Justice Department but not shared publicly. The Justice Department declined to answer NPR's questions on the record about these specific files, what's in them, and why they are not published. Other files scrubbed from public view pertain to a separate woman who was a key witness for the prosecution in the criminal trial of Epstein's co-conspirator, Ghislaine Maxwell, who is serving a 20-year prison sentence for sex trafficking. Maxwell is seeking clemency from Donald Trump. Some of those documents were briefly taken down and put back online last week, while others remain hidden, according to NPR's comparison of the initial data set with the document metadata of those files currently on the DOJ website. According to the newly released files, the FBI internally circulated Epstein-related allegations that mentioned Trump in late July and early August of August 2025, reports NPR. The list, collected from the FBI's National Threat Operations Center, included numerous salacious allegations. One came from a woman who directly named Trump in her abuse allegations, who claimed that around 1983, when she was around 13 years old, Epstein introduced her to Trump, quote, who subsequently forced her, and I will just say, to commit a sex act, after which Trump punched her in the head and kicked her out. Out of more than 3 million pages of files released by the DOJ in recent months, this specific allegation against Trump appears only in copies of the FBI list of claims and a DOJ slideshow. The FBI, as NPR reports, echoing what we've been talking about over the past week or so, interviewed this Trump and Epstein accuser 4 times. According to other documents released under the Epstein Files Transparency Act, only the first interview conducted July of 2019 is in the public database. That interview does not mention Trump, which, as reported previously, based on Sullenberger's reporting, was a condition of the interview because, quote, fear of retaliation at the time by Trump, who was then the president of the United States. So of the 15 documents listed in a log of this Maxwell discovery material for her trial, at least 8 documents are missing, NPR finds, from the database. Those missing also include notes that accompany 3 of the interviews, as initially reported last week by Sullenberger. According to NPR's review of 3 different sets of serial numbers stamped onto the files, there appear to be 53 pages of interview documents and notes that are missing from the public Epstein database. There is more, and I will point you to NPR's story when I publish today's show at bradblog.com. But following NPR's report, the House Oversight Committee's ranking Democratic member, Congressman Robert Garcia of California, released a statement about the missing files, saying, quote, "Yesterday I received unredacted evidence logs at the DOJ. Oversight Democrats can confirm that the DOJ appears to have illegally withheld FBI interviews with this survivor who accused President Trump of heinous crimes." They go on to say that they have already been investigating this allegation. And then Garcia also offered these additional remarks during a presser on Tuesday afternoon.
"I just want to remind the president and the attorney general that they are right now in violation of the law. And when the president makes a speech tonight, he is going to know that looking back at him will be numerous survivors of Epstein's abuse, and that he is facilitating the single largest cover-up in modern American history." It's the single largest cover-up in modern American history. And who are we protecting? Why are we protecting powerful, wealthy, connected men? Why are we protecting billionaires from justice? Because we're always going to center the survivors. The single most important part of our investigation and what we're guided by is justice for Annie. It's justice for Maria. It's justice for so many that have been wronged, harmed, and terrorized by not just Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell, but by the co-conspirators and all that helped them commit their abuse. Let's be clear. Over 50% of the files have still not been released to the public. And we know as early as just today and yesterday, there are numerous files that we have confirmed that are missing from the DOJ that we know exist, including accusations and serious accusations, not just against the president, but against others. It's time to release the files. It's time to center their survivors. And the president should know that even though he wants to call this a hoax, that our investigation is just getting started.
California Congressman Robert Garcia, ranking member of the House Oversight Committee, ranking Democrat, on this latest news that we have been trying to shine a spotlight on over the past week or so. As you might imagine, after NPR's confirming Sullenberger's original reporting and the Democrats on House Oversight confirming as well, many other outlets, happily, are now jumping in to finally cover this matter.
Good.
So, good, yeah. Glad they are catching up. It should be an interesting State of the Union address to cover on our next broadcast. Turning the page for the moment, sort of, to Trump's gangster chair of the FCC, Brendan Carr, and his latest threat on behalf of his boss to those who broadcast over your public airwaves. Let's take a quick break, and we will be joined by longtime attorney and communications law expert Harold Feld of publicknowledge.org. That is straight ahead, along with the Green News Report, right here on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
The broadcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from BradBlog.com. As we reported yesterday, the chair of Donald Trump's Federal Communications Commission, the increasingly notorious Brendan Carr, last week issued a statement urging those who broadcast over our public airwaves to sign a pledge to the FCC to, quote, air patriotic, pro-America programming in support of America's 250th birthday. As Carr noted in a statement, quote, as part of this effort, I am calling on broadcasters to pledge to provide programming that promotes civic education, national pride, and our shared history. This type of programming, he argued, is more relevant than ever as surveys show that civics education is in rapid decline. And classic programming, such as Schoolhouse Rock, the great animated short series from the 1970s, is now found only in online archives. Of course, as the Bradcast is heard on dozens of broadcast affiliate stations over our public airwaves around the country, that resulted in our decision yesterday to try and help meet what Carr described as the, quote, public interest obligations of the broadcast outlets by taking his suggestion and sharing a brief clip from a classic Schoolhouse Rock episode about the founding of our nation 250 years ago. And we are more than happy to do it again today, just in case Brendan Carr is listening, because even he may need to hear it twice.
Gonna hold a revolution now, king, and we're gonna run it all away with no more king.
We're gonna elect a president.
No more king.
He's gonna do what the people want.
No more king.
We're gonna run things our way.
No more king.
Nobody's gonna tell us what to do.
Rocking and a rolling, swishing and a splashing over the horizon. What can it be? Looks like it's going to be a free country.
Well, there you go. No more kings in the United States of America. It's going to be a free country, a very important piece of, as Carr describes it, civics education, national pride, and our shared history. You're welcome again, Brendan. Carr's call last week for the nation's broadcasters to sign on to a, quote, voluntarily choose to, quote, indicate their commitment to the Pledge America campaign, as the FCC is now apparently calling it, has some longtime experts in the First Amendment and public interest broadcasting area over our public airwaves a bit concerned. As Ars Technica observed on Friday after Carr's statement was released, quote, Carr has enthusiastically backed Trump's battle against the media by making numerous threats to revoke a broadcast station, to revoke broadcast station licenses. Carr targeted ABC's Jimmy Kimmel back in September and recently opened an investigation into ABC's daytime talk show, The View. In both cases, Carr said that he was enforcing the FCC's public interest standard. Stephen Colbert said last week that CBS forbade him from interviewing Texas Democratic U.S. Senate candidate James Tallarico because of Carr's threat to ditch the FCC's long-standing practice of exempting talk shows from the equal time rule. In response, Colbert chose instead to publish his interview with Tallarico on YouTube, where it is presumably exempt from broadcast station equal time mandates of the FCC, and where, as of Tuesday afternoon, that interview has now racked up nearly 9 million views. For an interview which would have received at best about 2 million views had it been aired as planned on the CBS airwaves, but for Colbert's explanation to viewers on The Late Show that CBS attorneys were essentially caving to Brendan Carr's suggestion earlier this year that he planned to review the longstanding 20-year-old exemption from equal time requirements for bona fide news programs that has long been applied for 20 years to late-night shows like Colbert's when interviewing politicians like Tallarico, who are running for office. Colbert, as you'll recall, is also in his last few months on CBS as his program was canceled last year, just after the purchase of CBS's Previous owner, Paramount, as part of an acquisition by a company named Skydance Media, which is owned by a very Trump-friendly CEO. Part of that merger included a ridiculous $16 million settlement that CBS paid to Donald Trump in response to his ridiculous lawsuit against 60 Minutes, charging that the legendary news program had somehow unfairly edited an interview with then-presidential candidate Kamala Harris in the run-up to the 2024 election that Trump actually won. Colbert described that payoff on air, arguably quite accurately, as a, quote, big fat bribe. And his show was subsequently canceled the following day for what Skydance Paramount described as, quote, financial reasons. As you may have noticed, this is a very perilous moment for broadcasters and for freedom of speech itself over our public airwaves, for both commercial and nonprofit outlets alike. You'll recall that Trump and the Republicans' so-called Big Beautiful Bill last year also resulted in the full defunding and subsequent dissolution of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and that the far-right Project 2025 document, which Trump pretended to distance himself from during the campaign but has largely been following to a T ever since taking office, well, that document specifically cited the Pacifica Radio Network, which syndicates the broadcast to hundreds of affiliate stations. It mentioned Pacifica by name, targeting it, too, for potential removal of its licensing as an educational nonprofit network. Joining us now to try and make some sense of all of this and how much we should see as political bluster or thuggery from the Trump administration and its FCC chair, Brendan Carr, and how much we should see as a very real threat to whatever is left of the First Amendment over our public airwaves, is Harold Feld, attorney and senior vice president at Public Knowledge, a nonprofit organization promoting, as the name suggests, the public's access to knowledge, freedom of expression, an open internet, and other works to shape policy on behalf of the public interest. Mr. Feld's work focuses on the intersection of technology, broadband, and media policy in both the private sector and in the public interest community. Harold Feld, thank you for joining us today on the broadcast, sir.
Thanks for having me. And I got to tell you, I got to laugh because I got into it a little with Chairman Carr on Twitter, or X, what he first announced this, and you know, I also brought up the No Kings. I'm hoping that becomes, you know, kind of the official pro-American celebratory clip that everybody decides to use.
Well, he was the one who asked for it. He said that, you know, that's the what we should strive for. So I'm more than happy to please Mr. Carr by playing that every damn day if I have to. All right, I want to step through some of the concerns that I just highlighted, including Carr's friendly suggestion that broadcasters voluntarily sign on to an FCC pledge and all the rest. But I covered quite a bit of ground there in the intro, and I want to make sure that I didn't, you know, either go wildly astray on any of it or leave out any key points as you see it before we dive into some of those points.
No, I mean, you know, you pretty much hit the nail on the head with most of that. I mean, there are kind of a couple of other things that, you know, there's the part of the whole Kimmel business was that two of the big group owners, Nexstar and Tegna, have a merger in front of the FCC, which actually requires the FCC to suspend a federal law about how many broadcast stations anyone can own. Mm-hmm. And folks may recall that as soon as Carr said Kimmel ought to be off the air, before Disney even did anything, Nexstar and Tegna both jumped out there and said, we're going to preempt that programming. And they even preempted it when Disney brought Kimmel back for another day or two before they finally gave up. So, you know, part of this whole business, like with the Skydance and everything else, is there's a real pay to play element going on here. And, you know, Skydance, which are the people who bought CBS and have, you know, made it all Trump friendly, they want to buy Warner Brothers Discovery. Mm-hmm. Netflix has, you know, got a winning bid in there right now, but Trump and the Trump Justice Department have been leaning very heavily on the Warner Brothers shareholders to vote to take the Sky Dance merger instead. Mm-hmm. That would, of course, give a Trump-friendly owner control of CNN. So this is a real moment here, you know, between these, you know, threats on the one hand and these, you know, promises and gifts on the other hand to suspend federal law, to ignore antitrust rules. This is a critically dangerous moment for our mass media and our First Amendment freedoms.
Yeah, and that sort of feels like to me in all of these issues, and I want to step through this so-called Pledge America campaign, and then we'll get to the equal time issues, but that's what sort of seems to undergird all of this. And that would include even outlets, companies, and so forth that don't have immediate business before the FCC. It seems like there's sort of this vague threat over all of this. So when you have this Pledge America campaign, this announcement, the FCC plans to join Donald Trump's so-called Task Force 250, celebrate America's 250th birthday, with the suggestion that broadcasters voluntarily join the FCC's Pledge America campaign. I mean, in one sense, Harold, that sounds anodyne enough. Nobody's forced to do anything. And yet I've seen quite a few folks out there over the past few days who are sort of troubled by Carr's statement. Should they be? All he's doing is saying, hey, if you want to volunteer, you can put your name here. What's wrong with that?
Well, as I've said a lot, unfortunately, in this administration, there's a huge, if somebody says, nice business you got here, be a shame if anything happens to it.
Right.
That lands very differently if it's an insurance broker or a mobster.
Right.
And unfortunately, what we have been seeing is that this administration falls into the mobster category, not the insurance broker category. Mm. So, you know, this, on the one hand, you know, volunteer when your regulator, who has a reputation for coming after you if you don't do what they want, tells you to volunteer and particularly tells you to volunteer in a particular way. You know, we're not saying like do Black History Month and, you know, show American history, you know, the good and the bad, warts and all, you know, be proud, but also, you know, recognize where we've fallen short. That's so not what they're talking about here. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes this potentially a trap, because it's one of these where, you know, if you don't sign, then it's why do you hate America?
Mm-hmm.
You know, see, this is just the elite liberal media who hate America. And, you know, if you do sign, then it's going to be okay. What kind of a thing are you going to show? Because if you don't show the kind of celebration that they're talking about, then again, it's going to be all, well, you know, look at these guys. They said they were going to celebrate America, but they hate America because they didn't show the right things, the things that we want to see. And
yeah,
when that comes from your regulator, that can mean anything from just, well, you know, I guess we're not going to do any kind of deals or ask for any kind of waivers. But it can also be like, well, you, the FCC has a thing called lack of candor, which means if you lie to the FCC, you can get in trouble.
Mm.
Now, normally that's a good thing. You don't want people to lie to the regulator, but mm-hmm, you know, given Carr and his reputation, it would not surprise me if, like, ABC thinks to itself, sure, maybe I'll try to get on Trump's good side and I'll sign up here. And then when they don't like something they showed, they say, well, we're going to investigate you for lack of candor, for lying to the FCC.
Right.
Now, that's total nonsense. But part of the issue here is, it's like if the police decide to hassle you, they don't need to actually arrest you. They don't need to, you know, in order to give you a hard time. The FCC mm-hmm can, you know, investigate, can, you know, make your life more difficult by asking for all kinds of papers and everything, hold up even basic license renewals. So, you know, it's not a trivial thing.
Yeah. I mean, and it seems like it would be one thing if he came out and said, hey, we here at the FCC are joining in the government-wide celebration of the 250th birthday. We urge broadcasters to, you know, air patriotic programming along with us. But the fact that he says, please sign here if you wish to take the pledge. And then at the same time, I notice in Carr's announcement, he calls on broadcasters, for example, to run, quote, PSAs, short segments, or full specials, specifically promoting civic education, inspiring local stories, and American history. Okay, that's good enough. He says, yeah, including segments during regular news programming that highlight local sites that are significant to American and regional history, such as National Park Service sites. Well, that also sounds reasonable, but if I'm a local broadcaster in, say, Philadelphia, and I run a story on the fact that the Trump administration has ordered the removal of signage at the president's house in Philadelphia, a National Park Service site where George Washington lived during the nation's founding, along with, I believe it was, his 9 slaves, they're removing that signage. If I report on that story, would that count as meeting Carr's voluntary Pledge America campaign, Harold?
Well, that's the thing is, you know, the implication is very clearly no. And again, this is, you know, kind of, you know, when somebody, what did I do? You know, when some like kid says, well, what did I do wrong? I just listened to what you said.
Right. Like,
no, we've got a history here. We've got a background here. We know what this administration means when it says they want patriotic and historical stuff. We know how Carr has been, you know, pushing on broadcasters and been willing to, you know, go very public about what he doesn't like and, you know, what he does like and you know, push them around and use his regulatory authority to push them around. So, you know, this is not just plain ordinary stuff. And yeah, you know, normally you'd expect like the FCC to the chairman of the FCC to say something like, you know, everybody should, you know, celebrate our history in America. You know, that'd be, you know, that's kind of, again, it's all fine, except the background here and the history here and the way it's being said, just it's like, you know, being asked why you're hitting yourself. You know damn well why you're hitting yourself.
You note in your comments to Ars Technica on this that well, that there's a bit of a tell here that the pledge is not truly voluntary, because if it was, it would not be limited merely to broadcasters. In other words, those who broadcast over the public airwaves versus cable or internet streaming, et cetera. Why is that a tell as you see it?
Right, because the FCC has jurisdiction over all communication in the United States. That's Section 1. It regulates some more tightly than it regulates others. So, you know, it regulates cable also, you know, Congress passed a different statute for regulating cable that is much more hands-off. It's very different. Again, this whole issue of the public airwaves, because broadcasters get their licenses for free. Mm-hmm. These are very valuable things.
Yeah.
Lots and lots of people would like to use them. So, you know, traditionally the government has set conditions on them, like we make broadcasters have a certain amount of children's programming every week that they're supposed to do. You know, there are some differences, but if this were just a general, hey, everybody, this is the chair of the FCC saying celebrate America, then it should be for, you know, everybody under their jurisdiction, cable operators, the satellite guys. I mean, even though internet communication is not generally regulated by the FCC, could have called on, you know, podcasters to say if it's just a celebration, then let everybody celebrate. And when I nudged him about this on X, you know, his response was, well, everybody's welcome. I'm like, well, that's great, but, you know, you didn't ask.
You didn't point out them. You only said, hey, broadcasters, the people that I, the outlets that I've been talking about, that I've been threatening lately, those are the only ones he mentioned. Interesting. Now, as to the last week's Colbert, CBS, FCC kerfuffle regarding the airing of the Colbert's interview with the Democratic U.S. Senate candidate James Tallarico, where CBS attorneys advised Colbert against airing that interview, lest he trigger the so-called equal time requirement of needing to offer time to Tallarico's opponents in the election, which is underway right now. But he's got two opponents in the current primary election for the Democratic Senate nomination in Texas. That would be Jasmine Crockett and Ahmad Hassan. Were the CBS attorneys right about that? Or would that trigger the equal time requirements, or were they simply obeying Carr in advance? Because as far as I know, the equal time exemption for bona fide news interviews on late night and daytime talk shows like ABC's The View, those are still in place, no?
Yes, exactly right. The law has not changed. And you know, the issue here is, and by the way, this goes back even further than the Jay Leno thing 20 years ago. It goes back to when Bill Maher was doing Politically Incorrect on ABC late night. They got a ruling on this in 1999. So we're talking more than 25 years where the FCC has been very clear, because this is a statute. This is, you know, Section 315 of the Communications Act, which lays out both the obligation and the exemptions. And the exemption says if you're doing a bona fide news interview, and the FCC has defined this for a very long time as being if it's the person is selected for their newsworthiness, if you, the broadcaster, control the interview, so it's not like, you know, you're asking them softball questions that they approved or anything like that, and you control the editing, then that is a bona fide newscast. And it doesn't matter what kind of TV show or radio show you're on. I mean, Howard Stern, when he was doing radio program, there's a ruling from 2003 that said, yeah, you know, in between your interviews of hookers and fart jokes and whatever, if you want to do an interview with Arnold Schwarzenegger, because he was running for governor at the time, you know, you can do that. And that's a bona fide news interview because he's newsworthy. You picked him for his newsworthiness. You're going to, you know, do a real interview with him. And, you know, that's all fine. And that law has not changed.
But there's been differing interpretations of that law, of what makes a bona fide news interview and is therefore exempt from the equal time rules, right? Going back into the 60s, wasn't there a different interpretation of this under the Tonight Show with Jack Parr? So I mean, it has changed in the past. Is there anything that would prevent it from changing again? Oh, now the FCC sees it another way.
Well, this is where you get into the what are you worried about with CBS and their lawyers? Because what could happen certainly is that the FCC could say, you know what, we just changed our mind. Now, an agency can't just suddenly just say, hey, you know what, we changed our mind. They have to have some reason for saying it. And, you know, they would have to have some reason why they don't think that this is the way Americans rely on getting news or something like that. They could challenge it.
And don't they also go through like a public comment period when they're changing a rule and all of that? Isn't there a format that you have to sort of walk through in order to do that?
Well, when you're doing what's called adjudications, you don't have to have public and comment stuff. That's for certain types of rulemaking, but the FCC makes its decisions, has two choices. They can either go with that kind of a rulemaking where they say, here's our new rule, here's what we want to do, public comment on it. We respond to the public comment that can get appealed up to a court to review. Or if it's something like an enforcement issue, they can say, well, okay, you know what? We're going to announce the rule as part of our enforcement. Now, there are limits to that, because if you do that, you're not allowed to fine anybody, because it would be unfair to fine you for a change in the rule. But they could say, yeah, well, you know, the FCC could say, well, you know what? we decide that you didn't meet the criteria. Or they could say, we decide we were wrong about the past. So from now on, you know, broadcasters, you've all been warned not to behave like whatever it is. And then that's appealable. What's very concerning here is that the FCC's, this is the Media Bureau issue, what's called guidance on this, is not only did they say you shouldn't rely on this exemption just because, you know, everybody has. People, the way they technically framed it was to say, y'all think that there's some sort of exception for talk shows generally, and there isn't, which is not what people were saying. People were saying that there is for an interview on a talk show that meets certain criteria.
Right.
But the chilling thing was when they said, and if it's motivated by partisan interest,
yeah,
then it's not eligible. So it's like, oh, now we're the thought police. We're going to go in and we're going to decide that even though it looked like you met every criteria, you did everything right, you obeyed the rules, but because we know you were really thinking, I want to support Democrats,
right,
now we're going to get you. And that is just crazy.
Yeah. I mean, all of this just seems crazy. And like we have, you know, I mean, we've had changes of administration, and obviously more, you know, the FCC will move more to the right or more to the left, depending on who's in office. But, you know, we've never had this, you know, as you described it, sort of this mobster environment underscoring all of this, which really puts a chill, it seems to me, on everybody. Or at least we should argue that it should put a chill on everyone equally. It doesn't seem to be. Harold Feld, are they applying these equal time standards or equal opportunity standards to only broadcast stations, or can they also be applied to cable outlets? Let's say, for example, Fox News, which now has its own late night talk show. Would this rule now apply to them or to even internet outlets, and should they be applied to them?
Well, it's a little complicated because on the one hand, the statute actually says that it applies to community antenna television, which is the old word for cable.
Okay.
But the FCC reads that as being only for local originated programming. So something national like Fox News doesn't apply. If you had a local cable system that was doing its own programming, or particularly about advertising that they insert at the local level, which is also covered by this, then it applies. So it primarily applies to broadcasters. That part is true.
What about right-wing talk radio, Harold?
That's where we get into it, because right-wing talk radio, if you want to talk about animated by partisan interest, talk radio, they make no bones about it.
Right.
You know, they're out there saying Democrats are evil, and you know, I want you all to go out and vote for this candidate who's a Republican, you know, whatever. You know, you don't have any problem. It's not about mind reading with them because they tell you up front.
Right.
But no, nothing about that. And the first time that Carr was asked about that, he said, oh, well, we don't have a problem. We don't see any problem there. Then later, when he got pressed on this a little further, what he said was, well, the same standard applies to all broadcasters, but because there was this misreading of the law by talk show guys, we decided we wanted to issue something that addressed talk shows specifically. I'm like, nobody was misreading the law, except for the Bureau, apparently, because they get a whole bunch of things wrong. But,
but right wing talk radio, I mean, would seem to fall precisely into what they are talking about. That's also a talk show. It's not a late night or daytime TV, but it's over our public airwaves. It meets all the same criteria, as it would seem to me. You know, Rush Limbaugh used to say he was an entertainer. Okay, you're an entertainer, but when you bring on someone to interview them, it becomes one of these so-called bona fide news interviews, does it not?
Or not.
I mean,
exactly. Right. I mean, if you're telling me you're just an entertainer and therefore this is just an appearance and it's not meant to be a news interview, then fine. You did just trigger the equal time rule, and you do have to have on another all of the opposing candidates and give them equal time. And that's where this becomes – you know, again, just sort of like, oh, yeah, the standard applies totally to everyone. Wink. I mean, this is not an administration and this is not a chair that believes in being at all quiet or subtle about this. And, you know, the really telling thing is that, and what makes this different from every other FCC and FCC chair has been, the FCC is an independent agency.
Yes.
Congress set it up deliberately like that because they knew that the power of broadcast is so powerful and has so much influence, particularly back when they created this, that if the president could directly control it, if it were subject to this kind of direct political influence, not just kind of indirect, hey, I'm appointing somebody who I think agrees with me, that would be awful for our democracy, that it would basically give the president censorship power and propaganda power over licensees. And Brendan Carr is the first FCC chairman to actually get up there and say, the FCC is not an independent agency. I work for the president in the same way that, you know, the Secretary of Agriculture or somebody works for the president. And that is not the law. That is not the rule. You know, I wrote a whole separate thing about why this is wrong, you know, put something online about it. But, you know, this is where we have a real problem, where we have for the first time, I'm not saying that, you know, we never had FCC chairs who didn't play the political game and, you know, did stuff that the president wanted. But this is the first time we've ever had anybody proud and loud go out there and say, you know, I am the servant of President Donald Trump. His will moveth through me.
Yeah, I mean, we've not seen anything like this, to my knowledge. I mean, you know, we always complain when a new FCC chair comes in. I remember Colin Powell's son, I think it was, under George W.
Michael
Bush.
Michael Powell,
right? Never anything like this. And frankly, I mean, Brendan Carr was previously, he was a commissioner on the FCC. It's not like, you know, he brought in some, you know, crazy MAGA loon from Missouri or something. He was a regular old, you know, Republican, but a regular old FCC commissioner. And now he's turned into, I mean, it's gobsmacking.
And this is, I have known Brendan Carr for about 10 years now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's a smart guy. He's a good guy, basically. On a lot of things that the FCC works on that aren't broadcast, I mean, look, I don't necessarily agree with him, but, you know, the FCC does all kinds of things like that you've never heard of and don't care about, like IP interconnection or spectrum auctions or all of these, where, you know, the FCC does its FCC thing and it acts, you know, like a standard Republican FCC. But, you know, on this broadcast thing, it's just crazy.
Because Trump doesn't know anything about, you know, IP spectrums and so forth. He knows about this TV stuff. Right. He's given orders. And I believe you that Brendan Carr is a good guy. He has always seemed like a good guy. But I'm sorry, I do got a question. If a good guy would roll over rather than, you know, resign when given orders to take a fundamentally statutorily independent agency and say, nope, we're not doing that anymore. We're going to, you know, go ahead and serve the king. I think Brendan Carr needs to watch a little bit more Schoolhouse Rock, if you ask me. Harold, I got to get out, sir. I could talk to you about this all day. I hope you don't mind if we call you again on this stuff because it's fascinating.
Please do.
And you're really, really enlightening on all of this stuff. Harold Feld is an attorney and senior vice president at publicknowledge.org. He wrote a recent piece on a whole bunch of this stuff that was really helpful if you want to understand how the equal time should and shouldn't work. It's called Equal Time, Unequal Enforcement, the latest move to weaponize the FCC against Trump critics. I'll post a link to it when I post today's show at bradblog.com. You can also follow them on Blue Sky at Public Knowledge, and you can follow Harold himself at Harold Feld on social media. Harold, really appreciate you joining us today. Hope to talk to you in the near future.
Great. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be here.
Thank you, sir. All right, let's take a quick break, and we're back with Desi Doyen and the latest Great News Report. Are we allowed to run that on our public airwaves still?
Gosh, I hope so, because we're going to.
We are going to. That is right after this. I'm Brad Friedman, and this is The Brandcast. Hey, this is Brad. Please consider supporting whichever progressive media outlet is supporting you and the things that you care about. Most, just like us, do not receive corporate or political support. We all need your support to counter the powerful corporate media echo chamber. Right now, as much as ever. If you choose to support us, you can do it really easily, safely, and quickly via bradblog.com/donate. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you.
You're listening to an encore presentation of The Bradcast.
Thanks again to Harold Feld of publicknowledge.org. Desi, are you sure we're allowed to run this? We haven't heard anything from the FCC on this. Anything from ExxonMobil? Anything from Shell? Any complaints? That, are you sure about
Not yet. We're so far so good.
Well, I was going to say that we're not doing our job. Let's get to it. Our latest Green News Report.
These are blizzard conditions.
Extreme winter storm batters the Northeast.
We're trying to fight those wildfires and keep them out of those major population areas.
Extreme dryness fuels winter fire weather in Oklahoma. Plus,
through my travels as a professional snowboarder, I've seen one common theme throughout.
Winter Olympic athletes call for climate action to save winter sports.
All of those calls and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Donald Trump has been named the undisputed champion of coal, and may our lungs be as black as his heart. Congratulations.
This is your Green News Report.
Yet another worthless statuette for Fat King Cole.
Okay, Desi Doyen, the rains have finally left us here in Southern California, but the rest of the country seems like it's a disaster out there.
It kind of is. Intense winter storms simultaneously slammed both the Northeast and Northern California over the weekend with heavy snow, triggering states of emergency and power outages. AP reports that the storm in the Northeast qualified as a bomb cyclone due to its rapid intensification. Forecasters say it is one of the most intense nor'easters in history, with thunder, snow, and lightning.
Very frightening.
Some areas saw record snowfall, which grounded thousands of flights and snarled transportation systems. Yes, man-made climate change is influencing the intensity of these winter storms due to record warm ocean waters providing energy and moisture to dump as rain or snow. Recent studies show that in the Northeast, the overall number of nor'easters has actually decreased since 1940. But when they do occur, the strongest nor'easters that do the most damage and have the most impact are unquestionably getting more intense, with higher maximum wind speeds and increased precipitation rates. One study calculated that nor'easters have become 20% more destructive since 1960.
Interesting. That sounds a lot like the pattern that we've seen in recent years for hurricanes. We're not necessarily getting more of them, but the ones we are getting are becoming a lot more intense.
Exactly. But in the central U.S., extremely low humidity, weird winter heat, high winds, and dry fuels have created fire weather from New Mexico to Kansas. Oklahoma is under a state of emergency. Ongoing wildfires there have burned nearly 500 square miles in the Oklahoma panhandle. Climate scientists have warned for decades that man-made global warming, driven by fossil fuel emissions, would intensify weather extremes, and all of this is unfolding just days after Donald Trump decimated the EPA's authority to regulate climate warming emissions.
So we're seeing wildfires in Oklahoma in the middle of winter.
Right. And over in Europe, they have been battered with a relentless series of intense back-to-back storms since early January that have killed dozens in Spain and Portugal. France has seen a record 35 consecutive days and counting of continuous rain, the longest stretch since records began in the 1950s, with soils across France hitting unprecedented saturation. Flood alerts remain in effect across Europe. Preliminary insured losses from the latest storm alone are estimated to top $3.5 billion. Oh. The storms have caused extensive damage to infrastructure and crops, raising concerns about climate-driven spikes in food prices. The Guardian also notes that far-right political parties that are gaining power across the European Union are pushing to roll back the EU's climate policies with help from the far-right U.S.-based Heartland Institute, which is funded by the fossil fuel industry. Finally, the 2026 Milan Cortina Winter Olympics in Italy concluded on Sunday night, and the irony of fossil fuel companies sponsoring the Olympics is not lost on the athletes, who have directly witnessed global warming's impact on winter sports. A recent study projects that only around 10 countries will be cold enough to host the Winter Olympics by 2040. Nearly all will have to depend on artificial snow. No. Over the weekend, a group of Winter Olympians delivered a massive ski fossil-free petition to the International Olympic Committee to end fossil fuel industry sponsorships. This is climate advocate and U.S. Winter Olympian Bea Kim. She sounded the alarm at a United Nations event last year focused on saving winter sports.
I've seen how the world is changing. The glaciers are melting that we're actually riding on. Our winters are starting later. The weather patterns are becoming more erratic. And each year we wonder if there'll even be enough snow for us to compete and do what we love.
There won't. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report. Very much. Our producer, Desiree Doyen.
Yeah.
And our guest today, Harold Feld, and all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. That is made possible by those of you who hit a donate button while you are there, helping us to continue throughout our 22 years plus of bradblog.com with your help. I think we got a Green News Report anniversary coming up as well soon.
Yes, we do.
Or you can go straight to bradblog.com/donate to, yes, help us stay on your public airwaves. Drop me an email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com, and you'll find me on the social medias, especially Blue Sky, at the Brad Blog. We will see you back here tomorrow with Digby and Driftglass on the State of the Union address. Until then, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.